the therapy that you need, baby, right here at home. Get lost in my body and pretend that nothing is wrong.
Quasi-cerebral talk and tunes. Broadcasting from unceded Coast Salish territories, this is Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. Here's your next hour of commentary and music.
But we just need one night off to apply that good pressure.
This is part two of a two-part series. If you haven't listened to the first part, go check it out now on cjsf.ca. CJSF broadcasts on unceded Coast Salish territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam First Nations, and Typically Tuesdays is produced on unceded territories of the Katsi, Coquitlam, and Stolo First Nations. By unceded territories, we mean that these lands were never surrendered, relinquished, nor handed over to neither of the states of what we know today to be Canada nor British Columbia. And at Typically Tuesdays, we recognize the host nations as being the original storytellers of this land. With particular regard to today's episode, we pose questions with our land acknowledgement. What are Chinese Canadians' relationships to these lands and to the state as racialized and Chinese settlers? How does being Canadian inform how Chinese Canadians navigate solidarity and community with other racialized individuals and Indigenous peoples in Canada? My conversation with Gal tries to explore these questions. Welcome back to Typically Tuesdays. My name is Leslie.
Hello, hello. I'm Gal.
Yeah, Gal is a local artist and tattoo artist who's joining me for this program that I'm decisively calling Chinese Canadian Power Hour. We have a playlist for today's episode, so the theme being Chinese Canadian Power Hour. The playlist is going to be called Chinese Canadian Power Hour the Musical, even though there's no storyline. It's just, you know, it's like, it's in the drafts, you know? It's just, this is a jukebox musical, and it's in the drafts. We're gonna start off with the first song. This is Shatter by Cutsleeve.
Of you in my mind, I am not one of your kind. Someone is waiting for me, waiting for me. Can't get you out of my head, can't put that face in my bed, but someone is waiting for. Got me under a someone is waiting on me. Thank you.
Welcome back to Typically Tuesdays. You just heard Beast by Yamantaka Sonic Titan. My name is Leslie.
And I'm chatting with local artist and tattooist Gal, aka Lucky.Money on Instagram. We are chatting about Chinese settler identity.
I just realized one way that we could make it just like even more Chinese Canadian, but it would be heavily inaccessible for a lot of people, is if we just talked in Cantonese the whole time. That is the option. It is community radio and I can do what I want because this is my show. I do what I want. We were just talking about like signifiers of culture and stuff like that. Today I should also mention, so we're talking today about Chinese Canadian things because it's July 1st on the day we're recording this. This is a day that holds some significance and some horrible things as well for Chinese Canadians. You can learn more by reading some good resources out there, for example by Chinatown Today, about Humiliation Day and the Chinese Exclusion Act. But we're trying to keep it a little bit lighter, I think, because we have already uncovered some trauma in some ways. We can talk a little bit about something that you brought up earlier, Gal, when we were trying to like organize this episode, is like having a mindful Chinese Canadian identity. I just realized this is not light at all, but we could talk about that. I almost wonder, I suppose something that is of a topic on having like a mindful Chinese Canadian identity is kind of like how maybe individually our identities have shifted over the years as we've as we've existed as children of the diaspora and also birthright citizenship Canadians or whatever. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes. There's like the general discussion and like the personal discussion. Well, let's talk about it this way. As a Chinese person, we don't benefit from a lot of xenophobia in our local area, which in my opinion is quite present, and I feel it. And it's not subtle sometimes. But I also want to keep in mind our intersections and being East Asian and Chinese, we're lucky to have, you know, community around us. And I don't want to say lucky because I don't want us to be lucky in this way, but we are lucky in the sense of like colorism and the model minority myth. And we're seen as like, you know, the better people of color to people that are racist. Can I say that? Okay, yeah. some of our bad stereotypes are that we're just really good at math, which is still very annoying. Like, I use my phone calculator these days. We are very privileged as like light-skinned East Asian people in the sense that we still get to like pass and have access to a lot of spaces, and that we are also not free of perpetuating harm to other BIPOC. And I think it's really important to remember that. I feel like what I see that as a trend, it's like, and it's good that we are aware of when we face racism, whether it's systemic and institutionalized racism or just general public racism. But I don't want us to only focus on that and get caught up on that, because we are privileged in certain ways over other marginalized groups, and it's important that we understand our intersections, our presence, how that affects other people, and to be mindful of it. I don't know how deep you want me to go into this, Leslie. I could bring up the previous example that I brought up to you, but yes. Okay. Well,
I mean, if you want to, I just wanted to kind of say, like, I If it's all right, if I like cut in here a little bit.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say, like, yeah, I think these are very important conversations to be having, like, amongst other Chinese people and light-skinned Asian people. Like, we benefit a lot from colorism, which has in some ways like trickled down to like things like class, right? And like, for example, like being able to purchase and own property on stolen lands, right? I think for me, like, I'll use myself as an example. Like, the term Chinese Canadian was not something that I ever really strongly identified with when I was younger. And then as I got older, it seemed like I had to kind of do that because of, you know, racism and stuff. But the more that I kind of like, sometimes I hear the term Canadian being ascribed to me, I feel like I don't really know if I agree with that, right? Because like, I don't want to I'm trying to do what I can to not be complicit in like settler colonialism. Yes. And then at the same, and like also recognizing, you know, the nation state is a social construct in some ways.
Yes.
And there's a lot of violence that can be like perpetuated by the recognition of the nation state. But then knowing also that, like, I don't know, yeah, like maybe in 3 years from now when we have like another election, my citizenship is going to get taken away because these fascists in our government are constantly trying to harp on like getting rid of birthright citizenship, right? And they're not gunning for like, they're probably not going to be gunning for like, you know, like a second generation Russian settler who's white. They're going to be coming for people like you and me. Mm-hmm. And my, like, going through that citizenship process is going to be is hard as it is.
Yeah.
Right. Like right now, it's going to be even more bureaucratic and even harder if they like bring those things in place. Like, so it's, for me, it's kind of like a complex thing. Then also, as you were saying, like trying to be mindful of like what spaces, in what spaces, what roles we should be playing. Like, in the space I can show up as a person of solidarity, and then in this other space I can show up as a person of solidarity away from that, because that space isn't necessarily for me. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes. I also want to talk about what you just like said like previous to this, but okay. For example, back in summer 2010, the BLM movement like had a huge resurgence in Vancouver. But also, just so everyone knows, BLM has been a thing, like even in 2010, but it just popped off in 2020. And I remember there was an event organized by our local Black community that I believe was supposed to be like a rally and then a cookout. And then like the poster said, everyone's invited, like, you know, and one of my friends, who is also very aware herself, and is also Chinese, asked if I wanted to go. And not harping on her in any sort of way, but this was like, I think, this example, this conversation is a good example of what looking into your intersections mean. I didn't feel comfortable going. And I said, I don't really want to take up space, especially if there might be like limited space for tickets, etc. I want that to go to someone who is like Black and in Vancouver to be able to access and celebrate with their community. Like I can be an ally, but I don't necessarily need to be there. And she asked me, she's like, well, the poster said everyone's welcome. And I'm like, yeah. And I genuinely believe that the organizers mean that. But I also know that as a Chinese person, I could make someone uncomfortable because as a Chinese, you know, person, as Chinese people, we're not like free of discrimination towards other people, towards other ethnic marginalized groups. So what might be me coming to celebrate, you know, with the Black community after a rally might make, you know, a member in the community feel unsafe and be like, you know, I was going to be here to celebrate, you know, and now this person who reminds me of like maybe a traumatic event I had, you know, even if I wasn't part of it, like, you know, that makes me feel unsafe. And I'm not going to be here to be like, but I didn't do it, so you should accept me being here. I'm like, no, I understand and I respect that. So I'm going to stay out of it. And the times that I should be showing up is when there are like protests and there is, I'm trying to make sure that I'm like safe for radio. When I should show up is when there are protests, especially by our Black or Indigenous groups, like be there to show up like in numbers and to protect protesters from cops. I would like to say that I believe in the summer of 2020 or maybe autumn 2020, somewhere in between there. There was a protest by our Indigenous community on the viaduct, and a few activists that I follow who are Black femmes stood in front of the Indigenous protesters to protect them from cops. And unfortunately, they were handcuffed and taken away to jail. But they did post online that there were white allies there at the protest. But as soon as the cops showed up, those white allies stood back. And, you know, we could go into the whole topic about police violence towards the Black community, both in America and Canada, and all that. But like, I feel like anyone listening to this would know, and I don't need to explain the ABCs of it all. And so, sorry, going off on so many tangents, that's when my presence would be more important, more useful. I'm not saying that I can never celebrate with like other communities. It's just that if I only show up for celebrations and I don't show up for when situations are tough, like, what does that say about my allyship? What does that say about my self-awareness of who I am? Like BIPOC solidarity is what we want, but we can't just say BIPOC solidarity and be like, yeah, you know, we're all together because we're BIPOC. And it's like, well, we need to be active and mindful about how we interact with each other, how we support each other, and, you know, what harm may have happened to one community from someone from our own community. You know, I think it's a little, it's well-intentioned to want to go, you know, party at this cookout based on that conversation I had, but you still need to, you need to step back and know that sometimes, like you said, Leslie, like support sometimes is not being present in certain things. You know, I don't know if this would be like on the show or not, but I'll say, like, if I was at a Chinese or general Asian gathering and it was like super important to talk about XYZ topic, yeah, I do want to see a bunch of people even outside of our community there. But if we're celebrating after a hard day's work of protesting and suddenly there's an influx of like white people here, I'm not going to tell them to get out, but I'd be like, where were you like earlier, man? Like, you know, maybe Brad was here earlier, so Brad's welcome, but Chad, where did you come from, Chad? You just heard there were free beers? Yeah, I don't know. You know what I mean? It's like you just come for the Tsingtao beers and that's it.
Before we move on, we're going to listen to a little bit more music. This is Yusu with Melaleuca at Night. Thank you.
The newest from local talent Sad China, produced by Dog Days Are Over, that was Rainbow Prayer. Before that, you heard Sukin Lee and Adam Liedowitz with Lake Girls. My name is Leslie, and you're tuned in to Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. I'm chatting with Gal, local artist and tattooist, about the complications, the complicatedness and nuance and stuff of being a Chinese settler living in Canada. We're going to continue on with the conversation now. Enjoy.
In terms of the term Chinese Canadian, I have a bit of a contentious, I don't know if contentious is the right word. I have a not very confident relationship with the term Chinese Canadian, because in one way I understand to certain people that unless I add the Canadian to the end of that, like I'm not going to be respected. But when I say Chinese Canadian, am I not like upholding, like you said, settler colonial thinking and being like, yeah, I'm Chinese Canadian, therefore you should value me? And then what about like my like more like new Chinese like immigrant like counterparts? Do they not count? Also, I'd like to mention, I actually had this conversation with a friend recently. I'm jumping between topics. But in terms of understanding our intersections if our, on our identity as a Chinese person and a Chinese Canadian, despite my shaky opinions on that on that term, I have a privilege because in this society, and I don't agree with it, but in this society, I'm lucky that like my full name can actually come off not Chinese. And I speak with an accent. So if you don't see my face, I have like a lot more access to spaces, like getting like a job, doing phone interviews and all that. I've actually like entered a few workplaces and when people see me, they're like, you have a very interesting name. How did you get that? And I'm like, my dad gave me a name because he asked his coworker, who's not Chinese, by the way. And then just being aware that like, we're not like a monolith and like, oh, all Chinese Canadians or all Chinese or all Asian people, we're all under the same struggle. No, I have quite a lot of privilege. And while I don't always, actually, while I always never say like academia is like, you know, something that should put you above others, I don't believe that. I actually think academia is very problematic. I still have the privilege of going to UBC, getting to go to different courses that taught me and gave me like the vocabulary and the tools to defend myself. I majored in sociology, just FYI, like why I have these tools. I'm able to defend myself and able to actually maybe make someone do a double take and be like, wow, I shouldn't mess with this person. Whereas like someone with a Chinese accent might be saying the exact same thing as me. And then someone here is just like, yeah, shut up, C word, you know? I think that's something really important to remember. And okay, bouncing back to that topic that I was talking about in terms of Chinese Canadian. I also say that like I'm fourth generation Chinese, but Chinese Canadian, but it's not something I'd like to bring up like in most conversations because I don't think the amount of time that my family has been here makes me more important than anyone else. But I have to bring it up in certain spaces because those people value that. And unless I bring it up, like they won't listen to me. And it's so weird and stupid that these are the values. And then like, when I had conversation, like I'm fourth generation Chinese Canadian. And people were like, wow, that's longer than me. And I'm like, yeah, dude, I know. It's just, was it so shocking that it made your brain rewire how you perceive me now? Am I more valid? Are you like, wow, like, you know, gal's actually like more Canadian than I am. And it's like, I don't know if I want to be more Canadian than anyone else because I'm not a fan of Canada's history, right? And also I just want to say this just on the record, we are simply squatters, you know? We face a lot of discrimination in Canada, but we are still squatters on Indigenous land. Let's remember that. So that's another thing about understanding our intersectional identities. Like when I talk about the strife the Chinese like community has experienced in Canada, like for histories, that is not without me acknowledging that we are on Indigenous land. And I would also like to state like two facts that I like learned a couple years ago that I've been trying to just like educate people on. When our people were building the railways, and when the railway was done, we were basically abandoned and left to die. Can I say die on the radio? Okay. We were left to die. And do you know who came to our rescue? Indigenous people. When white colonialists just left us because we finished doing the thing they needed us to do, and like our Chinese men were dying on the tracks, at the side of the tracks, Indigenous people were the ones to come gather our men and nurture us. Like, and that's why if you look into like Vancouver specifically, there's a lot of like Indigenous Chinese like intermingling history there. And also when it came to the Komagata Maru ship, they were not allowed to dock. Thanks, Canadian government. I can't remember how many days they were like just stuck like outside like our port. But basically everyone there was starving, ran out of food and water, were dying. Indigenous people were the ones to like canoe to the ship and pass over resources so folks could sustain themselves, right? So it's like July 1st, technically like quote unquote Canada Day. And, you know, I'd like to say that despite, can I say genocide?
Yeah, we're not like, okay. We're not hiding truths here.
Okay. No, I just don't know if it's like too triggering, right? Despite like colonialization and genocide, Indigenous people continue to be good and humanitarian. And I just want to mention that so we all remember. And also as a Chinese person, even though I mentioned a history of like Indigenous Chinese like intermingling, that's not to say that Chinese people have not been discriminatory and racist to the Indigenous community. And we have to remember that and be accountable for that. And I know the argument of like colonialism is like, well, my family didn't do that when it comes to like white folks being like, I didn't do that. Like, I'm against it. And it's like, but you still benefit from it. And Chinese people also, well, okay, a lot of immigrants still benefit, are harmed by colonialism, but also benefit on colonialism in the sense that we are still on stolen land and Indigenous people have not received like any ample sort of reconciliation. Anyways, I went on a tangent there, but this is just like many examples of just intersections. And I guess that's like an endless topic. The more you dig into history, like the more intersections you notice and the more things that you realize you have to keep in mind. And I don't think that's like a burden on anyone. I think it's good to remember. And it's more mindful. And I've had conversations in the past and in like my university days where I guess we weren't as progressive, where people are always like, what's the past? Or like, I don't think that's racist. I should be allowed to do this or do that. And I'm like, at the end of the day, if I were to simplify it, I don't, because I think we should have nuance. But if I were to simplify it, I would say like, this XYZ racist thing you're doing is harmful and makes this person from this marginalized group like feel bad. Also, like, I'm simplifying it, but like also generational perpetuated trauma, etc., you know. And I'm like, you want to have fun, and that's more important than making sure this person doesn't feel like crap because you're having fun in doing this. Which, if I wanted to circle back, is like everyone going to have fun at a speakeasy in Chinatown. I don't know how many speakeasies we're going to have in the next 5 years, but we already have two, and that's too many. I hope the business owners don't come for me. you know, like, I don't know if like we don't have enough grocery stores, are we supposed to have our like popos and our gonggongs like go to a speakeasy to have their like dinner? Like, you know? They're like, you know, this is all the money I have this month, but I'm going to get like this cocktail that references opium. And I'm going to have these like really expensive, like little appies of like, I don't know, edamame or something.
you know, Gal, I think it is all connected. So much of it is connected. You know, what we're discussing here about like having a complicated relationship with our cultural identity, and then also the, you know, what's on our passport, essentially, right? And then at the same time, kind of knowing what certain benefits we have because of that. And then, so how can we use those identifiers or those resources to show up for other communities as well? Is it's all interconnected. It's all so it's all very relevant. Something that I thought of while you were talking about, you know, your the conversation that you had with your friend and all these examples that you brought up. I think a lot of people, I'm not trying to throw folks a bone here, but I am trying to say, like, the way that I think activism and allyship is framed, particularly in this in the time that we're at right now, where like things are done very rapidly because like they're trending on social media and things like that, and it feels like everything needs to be done immediately. I mean, also because of, you know, the legacy of oppression makes us feel like we've had enough, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think it prompts like a lot of people who want to, who have good intentions, to unfortunately show up in ways that are beyond their capacity. And they don't really understand that, like, you can show up in ways that are within your capacity, right? Like, I remember on the similar topic, I remember like when my friend and I were discussing the protests that were happening around like Land Back and also around Black Lives Matter, we discussed like, you know, going to a protest it requires a lot, and you have to be prepared. If you're not prepared, for example, to potentially experience and see some things that are really awful, maybe stay back and like do some other form of, you know, like challenging and resisting, right? Because these things, going onto the front line isn't for everybody, no matter their intention, no matter how much good they can do, it's not for everybody. At the same time, it could be the opposite, right? Like, you know, like reading book after book after book is not going to be for everybody, but rather going on the front line and talking to people might be. And so many people like don't consider that how you express your solidarity does not always have to be like jumping in head first. Those, you know, the incident that you were talking about, the incarceration of the two Black femmes, it's very obvious that like those white people who showed up were not prepared to meet a police there, right? Like, if you're going to a protest like this and you think it's just going to be like a nice little kiki, like that's not what it is, especially if the most visible people are like some of the most marginalized people of our society, right? They are the easy targets.
It's also a privilege to assume that going to a protest where majority of the participants are Indigenous or Black, and it's a privilege to assume that cops are not going to get involved. Like, that, having that perspective is a privilege. So for like, I'm not saying like you need to fight the cops, like white allies, you know, like, I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying, like, you know, you're very privileged to be like, oh my God, I didn't know this was going to happen. This is so scary. And I'm like, that's still a privilege, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's very much like that. Like, obviously we don't want anybody to get arrested and we're not encouraging anybody to get arrested, but the fact of the matter is, like, you know, if you are not ready to, if you are not, like, fully informed, maybe don't show up to a protest, right? Like, if you don't know that, like, for example, if you don't know to remain incognito at a large protest, maybe don't be there. If you don't, if you're not ready to, like, put your freaking phone away, you know, don't go, right? Yeah. And I that's like, I've lost my train of thought. You want to say something?
Yeah. In terms of, like, trends and moving fast, I also feel like that was the case with, like, protesting, especially, like, summer 2020. Have I been saying 2010 earlier? I don't know. But summer 2020 is when a lot of, like, protesting became huge in North America in general, and Vancouver's was, like, definitely on the same trend. And I feel like everyone wanted to participate, but not everyone really understood the nuances of protesting and organizing and, you know, just, like, mobilizing yourself. And I'm not saying, like, oh my gosh, unless you're, like, super informed, don't even bother coming. I think it's important to have numbers. It's important to show up. But yeah, I think, like, there needs to be more conversation aside from, like, yeah, you know, like, I came because everyone's coming here. Like, my whole friend group in this chat said, like, we're gonna go support, and then you're done. Also, just on the flip side, I just want to mention, so people are aware, you've already touched on this, Leslie, like, going to a protest is not always accessible, and it also depends on if organizers make it accessible for everyone. For example, like, if there are maybe sign language interpreters at the front interpreting what speakers are saying, and if even, like, where the location is, like, can people access that? Not everyone has a car, not everyone has enough money to spend on transit fares, and sometimes, like, different people have different skills, so you maybe, like, contributing more by, I don't know, organizing on Twitter and letting people know, like, hey, just to be aware, like, the protest is becoming unsafe because on this end of the street, cops are coming down. So, and then you're just letting people know on Twitter, right? I actually saw that on a Twitter thread, that those were examples of how you can participate in a protest, even if you cannot physically be there, right? Even if you can't physically be there, like, you can also, I don't know, volunteer to paint signs for the protests, like, a couple weeks before, you know, and then give those out. You can look into a lot of different things. There's a lot of different things that people can do. And I think it's important to know that while we do need to show up in numbers for causes we care about, it's also important to diversify what we do and also lean on our strengths. For example, like, I am an artist, so I did a little zine to talk about how I feel with Chinatown and to educate people, right? Would me going into politics be just as useful? Probably not. I would say I would probably educate people with my words, but I probably wouldn't get anywhere in terms of politics. So yeah, like, we all have different strengths, and I think it's important to contribute where we can. And I think the term show up is really good, and people just need to know that show up doesn't always mean physically showing up if it's not accessible. But that's not to say, you know, just because you're better at doing art doesn't mean you should not ever go to a protest. You still should if you can.
Yeah, I definitely hear where you're coming from with that. There are many ways for people to show up.
We're hitting the top of the hour here on Typically Tuesdays. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Gal. I really want to encourage you, if you haven't listened to part one of this two-part series called Chinese Canadian Power Hour, please do so. It's up on CJSF's archive right now at cjsf.ca. Gal is a very thoughtful and passionate person, and I'm so grateful that they joined me on the show excitedly and so graciously as well, even though the invitation was so last minute. Very grateful for them and their work. If you're interested in checking out more of Gal's stuff and to follow their activism and art, you can find them on Instagram at lucky.munyi. That's lucky.munyi. Thank you so much again to Gal for joining me on the program. Tune in to more great CJSF programming by checking out Speak Up Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday on CJSF from 10 to 11, talking about local issues, topics, organizing, arts. Lots of stuff to cover there. Go check it out. Speak Up every Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, 10 to 11. My name is Leslie. Here's one last song for the hour. This is Electric Girl by Kwali. Enjoy.